Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John McMurtry. Oh, John has an extraordinary resume. What can I say? So much. He is world-renowned. I think I can summarize it that way. He's a retired professor emeritus at the University of Guelph, Ontario. He really is an international figure in all respects. And three of his books that I've read, mentioned them before on this program, Unequal Freedoms, The Cancer Stage of Capitalism. Oh, I hope we're deep in that stage right now with everything going on. And Value Wars. And we want to talk about the things on John's mind. I think he did a review of Andrew Kolin's book. Andrew was on this program a week or so ago, and we talked about his book, State Power and Democracy. Andrew was a wonderful guest, and I hope to get him back again. And John wrote a review on his book. I'm sure John would like to talk about that. Let me just begin with a couple of comments myself. So much concerns me all the time. My goodness, we could throw a dot at an issue board, and I'd be happy to talk to any one of maybe dozens of different topics, certainly a great many, and I manage to write about a number of them on a regular basis. Recently, I've written a number of articles on Iran, the idea of the IAEA coming out a report, not accusing, but making suggestive allocations that stop just short of accusations, and the way the Western media, mainly the U.S. media, pick up on them. Basically, they're saying Iran is a threat to world peace because they're developing, or they're working on, or they will develop a nuclear bomb, and we have to stop them. And the entire report was absolutely fabricated based on old information pre-2003. I have quoted from three national U.S. intelligence assessments, one in 2007, another one in 2010, another one in March this year, saying the opposite of what the IAEA said. And they were very brief on the topic of Iran and its nuclear program the last 2 years, using the identical language. I looked at it, I read it, and I read it again. They couldn't think of anything new to say. Well, there was nothing new to say. So both years, they repeated the exact same language verbatim. It was very brief, and basically it said, there is no evidence whatever to say that Iran is developing a nuclear bomb. It doesn't mean that they're not, but we can't find any evidence to say they are. Well, as far as I'm concerned, this is 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. America has 16 of them, not just CIA and NSA. Everybody's got an intelligence agency, the Pentagon, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, who knows, 16 of them. And their consensus they come out with each year, they basically said, there's no evidence to prove this. And translated to me, that says, America's intelligence is pretty good, I think. Does anybody have any better intelligence? Well, what that says to me is Iran is not developing a nuclear bomb. They've said it repeatedly over the years. The IAEA report can't really find it, so they just made suggestive allegations. But when Mohammed El-Baradei was the IAEA director general, he was there from end of 2007 to end of 2009, thereabouts. He was replaced on December 1 by Yukio Amano. El-Baradei is no hero to this program, but at least he gave IAEA some credibility. He got the same information. He would not touch it. He wouldn't touch it. He just said this is inflammatory, it proves nothing, and he would not put it out. So they got rid of him, and they got Yukio Amano. And he's a Western tool. And I quoted from a WikiLeaks cable what a U.S. State Department official, I think he was in Vienna, I didn't mention that in an article, but a U.S. State Department official basically saying, he's our man. He's with us right down the line. We can count. We're in good hands with Yukio Amano. And he didn't disappoint. Anyway, as far as I'm concerned, Iran is a non-belligerent country. It hasn't attacked another country in 200 or more years. It threatens no one. None of its neighbors feel threatened. When Israel says it feels threatened by Iran, it's lying. It's simply using it as a way to target a regional rival, because Israel doesn't want any rivals politically, economically, any other way in the region. No nation in the region threatens Israel. No nation threatens America. The only enemies they have are the ones that they invent. And they're all non-belligerent countries, and we have all of these wars. So is Iran next? Is Syria next? Who knows? I keep my eye on this, and I have a new article that I wrote this morning that gets into this topic. I wrote about the Arab League, and I'll put that out tomorrow. John, I welcome you to the program. I'll just mention the title of my article for tomorrow. I couldn't find a lot of information written about the Arab League. The kind of article that I wrote, I found a lot of bits and pieces. I called my article Arab League Pro-Western Despots.
You got it, Steve. You got it. I just wanted, before the program begins, to congratulate you for this wonderful award you've received for investigative journalism from the Journalists of Mexico. It's a prestigious award, and you very much deserve it. Just so your listeners know, this man is an investigative journalist that is now being internationally recognized as such, as the best. The award is for the best in the world that they are giving it for. So, from a very populous country indeed, and one that's involved very much in the struggles that we see across the world. So, congratulations, Steve. Just on the Iran one, of course, Iran.
Can I just make a comment, John? For you? I really thank you so much for that. You were internationally recognized many years ago, and for me, this is for me just a retired small business guy is the way I describe myself. And for me with that credential to get this kind of an award, I mean, to say it blows me away is a terrible understatement, but it really does. And I understand that the ceremony is rather elaborate. I spoke to one of their people just before I came on here. They called me about 30 minutes before airtime. We spoke for about 15 minutes, and I had to say, Would you kindly call me back, because I have to go on my program, and it's not a good idea for the host not to show up.
Oh, here we are.
Here we are, John.
Over ever more external territory and peoples. That's, by the way, a quote from Andrew Cohen. Is always the inner logic of the U.S. state, and of course this Iran thing has been going on now for years and years and years. And I'm glad you quote the old findings, because a lot of the old findings, you know, just disappear. As I'm doing the second edition of Cancer Stage of Capitalism out of Britain, a lot of that was originally published in 1999, and it has come through. Virtually everything in it is confirmed. It's just gotten worse in the very same directions. But these, to go back and recognize all these old data and facts and so forth that you just brought up with respect to Iran and the nuclear program, it's a good thing to keep track of them, because they'll go down the memory hole, the Orwellian memory hole, if you don't. And so the Iran thing has been going on ever since, well, it first started when they overthrew the democratically elected Mossadegh, which would have been a social democrat country back in 53 or 54, and that began the whole destruction, really, of any secular, social, democratic, or socialist development that happened in all of Arabia, basically all of the Middle East and North Africa. Africa. That's what they were on to, and I visited all those countries in the 60s, and that's what they were into. And they got where it had been, hadn't been overthrown yet, and of course this is Iran, going after Iran. They got Iran back by overthrowing the democratically elected presidents by force, and then it didn't succeed with the Shah, so the Shah himself got overthrown by this more fanatic Islam, which is always the response, always the systematic response of the U.S. Is not sponsoring these Islamic fanatics. They are growing up in the wake of the invasive, destructive, and resource-seizing logic of the whole U.S. foreign policy. So then when they come back in, what really is involved here, as I'm sure you know, is oil. They want oil, and they've been invading quite a bit now about oil. They've gone in, they've invaded Iraq, they've invaded the pipeline area that goes from Afghanistan into Central Asia, they've invaded, that's the whole reason for going after Libya, as you know. And so what we see here is a general pattern. Permanent war is the omnibus vehicle of the advance. Mass mind control, including by torture and drones, is the standard method. Mass propaganda will deny all the facts that you are trying to bring up with respect to the findings on the nuclear item. The nuclear is just a mode of self-defense. That's the only way. The only way you can defend yourself against really a kind of mad dog regime or a global police state, the only way you can defend itself is to have a nuclear bomb, unhappily, because that's the only thing it won't attack. It will not attack a country with a nuclear bomb. And so you just have this system of, the omnibus vehicle of war and mass mind control, and then continuous serial and mass murders going on now through drones as well as by invasions. And then oil is the big treasure. And it's not just Iran. You know what's going on in the background is watch for oil-rich Somalia to be the next target after Libya. Iran is kind of a diversion. It's one to keep on going at, because they are concerned about Iran getting a mode of self-defense that they will not attack, because it's always a cowardly system. It'll only attack helpless countries, countries that can't fight back. So they are concerned about that for that reason, because they want that oil back. They've done, they've been going since 1954 to keep that oil back. And so next door, we're not even watching, is Somalia. And I've wondered, trying to think in the world, where is the biggest cancer tumor that we can think in the world where everything seems to be in a state of a disarray, violence, poverty, starvation, and on and on. And Somalia is the place, and it sort of presented to me an anomaly as to, well, how do you use the cancer model to explain what's gone wrong in Somalia? And what I didn't know, so I decided to investigate there, is that Somalia, too, is an oil-rich country. We don't know that. It's also got a great deal of uranium. And it's already been usurped, It did get a moderate Islamic government called, I think, the Islamic Legal Party got in for a while, and it seemed to be unifying the country into some sort of unified governance. And that's the one thing that the U.S. does not want. They do not want a unified governance to defend this. The old president, Barre, he was kind of a tool, but he would not give the oil away. And so, of course, he is overthrown. And now it's a competing warlords. That's exactly what they want, so they don't have a unified country. The possibility of a unified country came in with the Islamic Law Party, and they were quickly invaded and so forth, using proxies like Ethiopia and now Kenya, in order to keep it constantly going down. And that starvation that we're experiencing now in Somalia, where 500,000 to 1 million people are in danger of starvation. It's a small population country, not even as big as Libya. I think it's 6 million. So this is the standard standard thing they want to take, a helpless country, drive the country into complete despair and disorganization, and then you can take their oil. And so they now that they got the party, the Islamic Law Party out, now what they're doing, you know, this drone attack, which is sort of, you know, we can do serial and mass murders as we please with these drones, and one of the active places, of course, is Somalia, and you never really hear about that. All you hear about is the terrible consequences. And so what they want out of Somalia is they want to divide it into four, and this comes from Kenya, actually. It comes from the Deputy Speaker of Kenya, who's aware of what's going on in the region, including his own country's involvement in this, they want to divide it into four weak gulfs, like, you know, like the Gulf State Emirates, you know, sort of royal absolutisms that are bribed into doing exactly what they want, and then they can control the oil. And Somalia then also, at the same time, while they're beating the drums about Iran forever, because they do want that oil back, they want new oil. Well, Libya isn't enough. They're going to keep on invading every country they can. And, of course, once you've got a country that cannot defend against air attacks, a nuclear weapon certainly can do that, then that's the first qualification for attack. It's weak, it's helpless, it can't defend against attack, and it's got oil to seize.
Somalia also is very strategically located, John,
yes.
Right on the Horn of Africa, and you've got I forget the name of the straits, but you've got Yemen on one side, you've got Somalia on the other side. Territorially, it's fairly good sized, and you're right. I mean, this country has been embroiled in war and violence for over a couple of decades. Listeners probably remember. Some of them may remember those old enough when George Bush Sr. got involved in a war in Somalia, and Bill Clinton, when he came in, he was involved, and U.S. forces were really chased out because a few of them got killed, so we turned tail and left. But we've turned that country, just like Libya, into a charnel house. And
yeah.
I mean the horrors that go on there.
See, what people don't realize, they think, you know, like in Iraq or in Libya, when it will fail and it will turn into a disorganized charnel house, corrupt and so forth, all of this will happen as it happened in Iraq, and it's happened everywhere the U.S. goes in. I mean, this is a very, you know, it's in a state of rapid decline, and it is really only good now at killing, and that's really the only place that it leads the world. Is in modes of killing other people. And people are inclined to think, well, you know, it didn't work in Afghanistan, it didn't work in Iraq, and in a way, obviously it did not work. It absolutely destroyed these societies. You know, by the way, both societies that had socialist parties governing them beforehand, which is always what they attack. And if it's helpless, and then they can seize the resources, and they think, well, they failed in Afghanistan, they've really failed in Iraq. They haven't failed at all. They've gotten everything they wanted out of it, which is control over the oil fields, and control over in Afghanistan, control over the oil fields in Central Asia, as well as a strategic site, which has been a strategic site for 2,500 years. So they've succeeded before. It was an external control. It was under the control of somebody that wasn't just a puppet for them. Anything that's not a puppet for them, they will attack. And the success for them, the strategic, you know, self-maximizing payoff matrix for them is to get the oil fields and to get the control of the strategic sites, but basically the oil and natural wealth of poor and defenseless countries. Against that is bombing from above the clouds. That's what they're interested in. They haven't failed there at all. They've got just what they wanted. Project for a New American Century has destroyed the United States, indeed, along with Wall Street, and it's destroyed the whole of really Europe. But that's not a failure for the people who are in charge here and for the system that they are at the head of, because they're really just replaceable functions that carry on. It's a crop system. That's not a failure for them. They have got all the treasure. They don't care if society, if world society, if civilization itself collapses. I mean, the depth of the corruption is best disclosed in the U.S. sudden defunding. This is really a remarkable thing of the United Nations, UNESCO, United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And that's, by the way, the sole world, the sole global body of science, knowledge, and culture. There's no other body that has science, knowledge, and culture. And the reason they suddenly defunded, that is, reneged on the old dues that were due, over $80 million that were due the next week. Why? They did it because UNESCO had admitted Palestine into its cultural organization, its educational, scientific, and cultural organization, by a democratic vote. Well, what could, they pull the funding on the world's sole unifying body of knowledge and culture and science, and they do it because Palestine, the mind sort of reels at it. In a way that this single decision of state is really oozes to the surface all the rot that's at the core of this system, that it has no pretense of value really left at all. First, there's the monumental ignorance and equivalent to book burning really involved here. The U.S. pulls its promised funding for, among other things, in UNESCO, an organization, by the way, which I've worked with very, very closely, the UNESCO Encyclopedia. The UNESCO Encyclopedia has got it's got everything in it. It's got the earth and atmospheric sciences, the mathematical sciences, social sciences and humanities, physical sciences, on and on and on and on it goes. It's the most comprehensive body of knowledge and science in the world. And they are just they are ruining it. Why? Because it lets Palestine in, who has been war criminally occupied, into its membership by democratic vote. And so second, you get Palestine, the long promised state we've been hearing on and on about, that Palestine being a promised state. Well, of course it was a state, it was a people before it got occupied war criminally. It's illegally occupied by Israel's armed forces, backed by the U.S., and so it's denied even a role. This is what's so revealing about this event, which was hardly noticed. Is so revealing about it is that it's a completely peaceful activity of science, culture, and humanities, and so forth. The world is, as I say, the biggest single body of knowledge and agency in the world of this. They bring Palestine into this, and so even the peaceful science, letters, and cultural participation is illegal. That's not allowed. At the very same time that they claim the U.S. strongly supports UNESCO and strongly supports Palestine as a state. The very moment they're doing this, they're saying they support both. The lie, the Orwellian lie, it just, doesn't seem to have any bound to it. I mean, but it doesn't end there. In the third respect, we have the war criminal of occupation of Palestine continues in the longest supreme crime in history of occupation, and that is since we've had world law. And so, while all the while they're claiming they want a negotiated peace with who in charge? The war criminal invader and the war criminal imperial country that's allowing it. That's who they want to have controlling the negotiations, and that's called the way forward to peace. I don't think anything in Orwell matches this.
Oh, absolutely.
And the cat of global big lies and national crimes. Then they say that we're going to have, I'm sorry, Steve, I just lost it there.
Well, the idea of negotiating peace, first negotiate a peace agreement with Israel, and then we'll talk about a state. Well, Israel refuses to negotiate peace, John. I have quoted Netanyahu, the prime minister, saying, he said a lot of things, but he basically just mocked the very notion of negotiating peace. A waste of time was one of the things I quoted him saying. I mean, Israel absolutely doesn't want peace any more than America wants peace, John. To have peace would run counter to their objectives. They need turmoil to be able to say there are bad people out there. And that's the reason we need big armies and heavy weapons, and we have to go at these people because there are terrorists around there. Right. I mean, these are people who just want to live free, and they don't want to bother anybody. They don't want anybody to bother them.
Well, you know, the last point I was going to go in there, but I guess, you know, when you came in, it just sort of threw me. The last point was really almost the most stunning, is that the U.S. justifies this, saying they're forced to comply with their own laws. Of course, their own laws are just police state laws. But the most extraordinary thing is that what's happening here is the very denial of Israel's right to exist, which has been just used as the justification for 40 years for doing all this. That very denial is a denial of Palestine's right to exist by this decision. They deny its right to exist. And when that's the very justification for Israel's occupation and carrying on forever, is that their right to exist has been denied. So we have the contradictions and absurdities of this thing really exposing the innermost depths and recesses of the global despotism, really an enemy of knowledge, culture, and law, as well as always, always the dispossessor by force of the poor and homeless.
Oh, it sure is, John, and unfortunately the logjam is headquartered in Washington. If Washington would simply realize that supporting Israel down the line harms U.S. interests, I mean, literally at times harms U.S. interests, there's no reason not to recognize Palestine. I mean, they are a state. Francis Boyle, who's been on this program, he was their legal advisor in the 1980s.
Yeah.
He drew a law professor, distinguished international law professor.
Yes, I know him well. Yes.
Oh, he drew up their Declaration of Independence, and he made certain it was loophole free. And I mean, if he did it, I know it was done right. And Israel and Palestine declared itself a state in 1988. So the issue with the UN isn't statehood; it's official recognition that it really is a state, a legitimate state. It complies fully right down the line with all the rules that the UN sets up to admit a state. And the only missing link is to admit Palestine as a full member with the same rights as Israel.
Yeah.
The same rights as America, the same rights as every other member state. And Washington has rigged the system, along with Israel, to block it. And
block even peaceful participation in UNESCO. That's the killer for me, is that, you know, they can go on saying it's a threat and they're fanatics and they're, you know, into jihad and on and on and on with Orwellian excuses. But when they stop even their peaceful participation in culture and science and education and use that as a reason for defunding UNESCO itself and for, you know, stopping any right to exist of Palestine, the mind just boggles. But you say, well, it's not even in the U.S. interest to do that. Of course it's not in the U.S. interest to do that if you understand the U.S. as a territory of people where you're considering the actual people involved and their actual interests of being able to be a self-governing and prosperous society. It's obviously so opposed to those interests as to be at war with them. What it is, though, very much in their interest to do, because they're a cancer state. And the cancer state simply occupies, invades, occupies, and multiplies itself in, you know, money terms, being the basic unit of the social life organization, the way the cell is on the individual organic life level of life organization. And the interest of the cancer is to do just what they're doing. And you say, but that's no, you know, that doesn't make any sense at all. That's just sort of self-destructive, not in accordance with its self-maximizing its self-maximizing metric and method of understanding what the situation is. All it's interested in is multiplying private money command over people, resources, and everything else in the hands of the private possessors at the top of this cancer system. And so they're all getting, as I was saying earlier, they're getting what they want. They're getting access to the oil. They're getting access to the military sites. They're getting that, you know, and basically it's a ruling class system that has gone completely corrupt and depraved. As I say, the only model that fits it is the cancer. In terms of its interests, these depraved interests, everything follows. It follows predictively. That's the thing about when you do use the cancer model, it's predictive. You can tell what they're going to do next when you think of it, well, it's a cancer invading the rest of the world. What will it do? It will go on invading and multiplying its money and military command because, you know, just as in the individual level of the cancer where it just occupies the organs and destroys them in order to multiply itself, that's what it'll do until it's stopped.
John, we're going to take a quick break. I absolutely agree with you 100%, and I do. I've read your books, and I do understand what you're talking about, and I am fully in agreement. I mean, these people literally need turmoil and all the rest of it to keep their cancer growing, and just, oh my God! I mean, they thrive on human misery and destruction, and,
yeah,
and all the ways they profit by it. Let's take a short break, John, and we'll come right back. Welcome back on with John McMurtry. Oh, talking about so many things. John, I want to let you continue on the areas that you want to focus most on. I'll just turn you loose and let you continue. There are so many issues. We both obsess over them. I know I do all the time and you do. And let me just let you go on. If you want to continue on this one, please do. Otherwise, pick it up with any other ones that you want to discuss.
Well, my worry is that the U.S. state itself is programmed to liquidate whatever serves life. And this is the model frightens me, the model, the carcinogenic model of diagnosis of what's going on, but it just seems so predictively to pan out, and that's what you always look for in a model. So other words, it's actually programmed to liquidate what serves the life of people. Well, why is it doing that? And that's doing that in order to grow transnational corporate and banking profits, money profits. That's always what it's doing, always. But always to do that, people are not stupid. People know their own interests normally, but so always you have to have a demonic enemy to justify what you're doing. If you're the cancer, you've got to say there's something worse than us, far worse. This is and they'll always portray a diabolical enemy. It can be communism, subversives, Islamic militants, terrorists, violence threatening protesters, whatever. Notice they're always without criteria. There's never a criterion of what a terrorist is, because obviously a criterion would pick out the U.S. itself as the world's great terrorist. And in fact, this designated enemy mode of moving the money profits of the money party, which is really in charge here, of moving the money party's profits on and on and on, they always have to have enemies. And you'll look back in American history and you'll see right from the beginning, that's the enemies. There's been American Indians, the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and then the genocidal laws and the military attacks on them. And they give the program right from the beginning. And then, of course, the Sedition Acts, the Alien and Espionage Acts, the CIA itself, the Internal Security Act of 1950, the House Un-American Activities Committee, where even to be un-American, that is, if you're not following this program, you're an enemy, and therefore you'll be ruined. You can be properly ruined. And if you're external, not only ruined, if you're internal, that you're say someone like Paul Robeson, who's the most talented man who ever may have lived, but his All-American status is removed in the Sports Hall of Fame, and on and on and on it goes. So if you're from another country and you're not going along with the program, then that means that you can be bombed. So always the enemy designation is the key to the system's advancing. But always, in fact, warred upon is not an enemy of despotism, which they always say, or of communism, which they always say. Always warred upon is something much more focused and concrete. That is people's social life support systems. Their natural life support systems are seized for their resources, and their social life support systems, that is, for example, social programs for higher education, health care, and on you go, the whole social state as we understand it. That is always what they attack everywhere. It's an invariant target. No matter what war you're talking about, no matter what civil disobedience you're talking about, they're always attacking one way or another people's social life support systems in order to keep everything in the private corporate sphere. Because anything like health, for example, anything that moves into the public sphere works much better and actually serves the life of people, and that is the enemy to this cancer system. So it always attacks it. So you just think of the examples. What are the worst examples that we can think of in our life? Well, that's what Yugoslavia had, and until Reagan, he did a secret directive that just basically instructed a destabilization of the Yugoslavia, which they did again. As always, they'll use money if not weapons. The money came first, then the weapons. Having their own people in there in order to pull an IMF-type program on them, where the whole dividing of the peoples, like this was the Balkans, this was a place that was impossible to make peace with Croats and so forth, involved against Serbs and Macedonians and so forth. Well, they broke Yugoslavia and they end up bombing it. And what did Yugoslavia have that they wanted? It wasn't really a particularly strong resource area, though it, of course it has resource and strategic importance. What it had was all the universal human life necessities being provided by social means, and that is the enemy. If life security itself is the enemy, then you think of Iraq. Of course, we've done Iraq enough times, but that's all it was really. Iraq, despite their putting in of Hussein, who he was there, he was on the CIA payroll, they still couldn't break their socialist infrastructure and their socialist government. In fact, it was governed by the Communist Party for years, and they couldn't break it because it was so popular with the people, so they put in a stooge and killer, Hussein, and then they turned on, which is a standard pattern. They put in a person, and then they turn on him because he's very vulnerable to attack and takeover, as they did in Iraq, which was the most developed social society, social infrastructure in the whole of the Middle East and Central Asia, and Libya being the only other one. And of course, that's where we go to Libya too. That's what they were really doing in Libya, grabbing the oil, grabbing the natural resources, and destroying the social infrastructure of the society, so it's helpless without complete control by an exploitation by the private financial interests of oil corporations and so forth. So you ask yourself, where have they not done this? Where has it not been the case? Just that law, that seizing their natural resources and destroying their social life support systems. Where have they ever gone except there? And then we have happening on the, this is really the thing that's most dramatic, is that this happens also at the domestic level. They're not just doing it abroad, they're doing it inside the states. And of course, Reagan was brought in basically to do that. And following quickly on Thatcher's, it was basically the market is the only thing that exists and anything else needs to be destroyed. They almost put it right out there. Of course, they had an ideology to justify it, but what in fact it was doing was turning everything over to private money sequences to multiply without inhibition or limit. And so this was going on, and so you have the attack on the social infrastructures of Canada. That's happened, and you had it happen in the States, even though it was somewhat underdeveloped in that regard. Whatever social life infrastructure you've got, this will be attacked, and it will be converted into the money cancer. And that's exactly what goes on. It's predictive. Well, then we have in 2008, we have not only the defunding of Social Security happening itself, which, by the way, you as an investigative journalist have been right on the case of happening under the Obama administration, and your argument, I think, is true, is that Obama was Wall Street's choice not only because he gives a brand change for something that's been disgraced, but he also provides something an in to destroy any social infrastructure, social programs you've got left, because he appears to be a Democrat and he appears to be a progressive person. He's the only guy who could get away with it, is basically the argument I think you correctly posed.
Oh, absolutely.
And then the Wall Street is putting these fraudulent bonds out, not just within the States, but all across the world, especially in Europe. That's really at the base of this whole European crisis, these fraudulent bonds coming out of, that everybody bought, coming out of Wall Street, because Wall Street runs the money system of the world. And then they're so, being a cancerous system, multiplying itself without inhibition, invading, occupying, moving into every domain of life domestically, as well as attacking every country abroad that has any so developed social life infrastructure, they eventually, like a cancer, eventually kills the life host, and that's the process. That's really what's happening now. They kill themselves in the sense of the money dries up because it's all fraudulent, and people eventually it comes to terms about, you know, can any of this money be paid that they've generated out of there, which is, as I say, like a cancer sequence behaving with all of hallmark characteristics. And so then they take, instead of at this moment, this could have been the turning point of the whole thing, you have failed even in your own terms. You are not even good at money. And just taken over, you know, just the way we've had, you know, with German banks, as you well know, and as Canadian Bank to some extent, public banks have long been the source of managing through crisis. It's known to work through hundreds of years, and of course, Obama being a Wall Street man, really, he and all his appointees, they just refunded them by trillions of dollars, and you know it's up to 13.2 trillion and still counting of public funding of the very money cancer system propelled by Wall Street to get them back in business to go on doing it. Well, they're not even lending the money now. But the key, just to go back to the unifying principle of all of it, the key is that you end means of life guarantee to everybody except the cancer itself. And that's the way the cancer operates. Try to think of any counterexample to that, of any counterexample to any decision or policy that's been taken to end the means of life guarantee to anybody at any level, at the level of their health, at the level of a living wage especially, at the level of even libraries and museums, at the level of bridges, at the level of anything. Any means of life that is not under your control and you can't transform into a money sequence is destroyed. Try to think of any exception to it. And so that's what drives one to the cancer diagnosis, because it just behaves just like a cancer. And so even when we have, you know, the freedom, when we have an apparent dimension of free speech in America, but you'll notice that if any of that free speech gets into social control of anything, like health, or like the banks or anything like that, then that's the enemy that will be attacked. And that's why the people in the Wall Street occupation are afraid. They're afraid to mention any policy alternative, because then they'll become the target of armed attack, as one always is if one moves towards social life infrastructure and any kind of security of life for anybody at any level. And so anybody who's moving in that direction will be attacked. And of course, that's what we're actually right in the middle of such a face down right now. And that's why the Occupy Wall Street people are really not coming out with an alternative, even if they know them. I mean, I've spelled out the alternative. You've spelled out the other, most simply speaking, banks as public utilities and public loans to government as it used to be and has been successfully. Those very most obvious primary moves are not even speakable. Even you can't even care about. Notice that it's not only that they will always attack any secure life means of any society or any, you know, any domain of your own society. The caring about, even caring about your fellow citizens, or worse, caring about other people in the rest of the world, that's the enemy designation. That'll make you a communist, that'll make you a socialist, that'll make you a liberal. Or if you care about the environment, that'll make you suspect, you know, you're a suspect for being an eco terrorist. They'll out, even caring, like the not, I mean, one of the places that, one of the things that, that the State and Democracy pointed out was the, and I don't know whether you remember about the nuns, who protested against the, you know, they took the caring about others, okay, they care about the fact that they're gonna bomb Iraq and that they're gonna kill what ends up being 500,000 people, 500,000 just, children. They protested before, and they were arrested, they were handcuffed, they were left on the ground for 3 hours, they were jailed 7 months before trial, and what was the charge? Sabotage and obstruction of justice because they painted blood on a missile. That is, even caring about other people's lives, let alone providing socially through social life infrastructures, which are the only thing that has ever worked in human evolution, it begins in language itself, even caring about it is an offense, but and it will have a law to catch it. And so if you express that. So,
John,
can I
give one example,
please,
which is a very important one to me? You're getting into Andrew Colin's book, and Andrew was on the program. I don't remember if I mentioned this when he was on, but I've had a program before on this. I've written about it three times. There is a lawyer by the name of Paul Berggren who was under indictment, something like 33 charges against him. I mean, the most serious things, racketeering, drug running,
yeah,
murder. It goes on and on and on, a conspiracy to commit all these crimes. Paul Berggren, as far as I know, is an absolutely innocent man. He was targeted like these nuns, John. He defended U.S. soldiers charged with a crime in Iraq for obeying their superior's orders. And he wanted the higher-ups put on trial. He
yes.
wanted the commander
Under
or colonel put on trial. He wanted their leaders put on trial. He wanted to go up the chain of command of the Pentagon to the highest levels, the Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, George Bush, and
absolutely
of course they
right under international law.
Oh, well, I mean, they not only shot him down and wouldn't allow any of this to happen, they went after him to silence
yeah.
him, and he's been in a New York City jail lots of times in solitary confinement. He's now, I believe, in his third week of his trial, and about a week ago I wrote about him for the third trial. This is an accomplished defense attorney and prosecutor. He knows the system. He's so good that opposition lawyers never wanted to go up against him, but he's in the fight for his life, John, and whether he's going to win it or not, I don't know. The state wants to put him away.
It just fits so. That's Paul Berggren, you see. I don't even know about that case. Is that Paul Berggren?
Paul Berggren, and he was a New Jersey lawyer, New Jersey prosecutor.
Well, you'll send me one of your articles on that, please.
Oh, I absolutely will.
Yeah,
I absolutely will.
That, you know, you're right. That's a paradigm example. It fits perfectly. What he's doing is standing for life protective law, world law as we've developed it through finally through history, and he's saying life protective law ought to be you ought to be accountable to it. It's in the books. The U.S. has thrown solemn covenants to it and so forth. And so just for saying that life protective law has to apply, he is put in prison. That's police state. That's police state beyond ones we've really recognized before. It's so vicious.
Oh, indeed. Absolutely, John. And I'll throw in one more very quickly. Lynn Stewart, who was asked by former Attorney General Ramsey Clark to be a member of his defense team because everybody in this country is entitled to a defense, and she joined the team defending an Arab sheikh who was an innocent of the charges, but they put him away for life, and they have Lynn Stewart because she committed a noble act. She's serving 10 years in prison, John.
God almighty.
And I know Lynn Stewart personally. And I know her husband. This is the way this country operates, plus all the other political prisoners languishing in U.S. prisons. America has the largest prison gulag in the world. That's beside the one overseas. I'm talking about the one right here in this country.
Yeah, with over 2 million people. It's much the worst in the world.
Awful. And they commit torture there. When they went to Iraq, John, to do their horrors at Abu Ghraib and other places, Afghanistan, the same thing, they drew on U.S. prison officials to go over there and run these facilities with the U.S. military because they know all about the harsh practices in U.S. prisons. This is the stuff that goes on here that never gets a word mentioned about them.
No,
it's
quite
media.
Amazing. It is the most dangerous place in the world. As a young man, I was a wild young guy, and I've been in a U.S. prison. And my thought was at the time, because I thought, well, this is sociological research for me. I'm a young guy, and trying to figure out the world, and coming to the conclusion that because it's really a cage, is what it is. They're cages for human beings, and most of the people inside there are in there for no violent offense at all. It's over 85%. I've not committed offense against any person at all. Their real offense is that they're rebellious or they're poor or they're consuming a non-pharmaceutically sold product. I mean, that is harmless. It's just like there's really no justification for almost all the people in jail being in a cage. In a cage, and my experience of it was that I would kill myself rather than have to go through that for a week, let alone a longer time. That was my experience, feeling as a young man. I suppose as an older guy, I would be the way that many, hopefully, you'd be as many heroic guys have been inside prisons like Mandela. But it is so hideous, and my experience too of the the guards and the police on the way to it, you know what it was for? It was something like one of my friends threw a bun inside a restaurant. That was what it was for. And that what I sensed in these people, from the police through to the guards and so forth, is they wanted, because America's, you know, I get basically amongst the large part of the people, especially the police and the guards and the army and so forth, I kill, therefore I am, is their inner motto. And I sensed that because these guys, which I was a strong young guy and capable of cleaning up on any two of them, I was a very strong, tough guy. But they loved that. They loved the fact that they could bully. And they loved the thought because they were reaching like a guy on the draw for their gun to shoot you. They really wanted that to happen. So that's the kind of tyranny that goes on inside those prisons. 2 million Americans are inside that prison, mostly for no offense against anybody. So you're right about it being a gulag. I would think that in a way the gulag is dwarfed by what's going on there. And what it means is it's, you know, like we see in Abu Ghraib, which is, you know, we've seen more pictures of it, it means they can do anything they want to you. They can do anything they want to you, and you can't do anything about it. That's the key. That's what a police state is, by the way. It's unlimited power of armed force, freely discharged without any citizen's right to resist or oppose.
That's exactly right, John. And writing about the U.S. prison system was one of the first articles that I ever did, and I still remember the title. I've got so many titles, I can't remember too many, but I remember this one. I called it the U.S. Gulag Prison System, : The Shame of the Nation. And how many people in this country know anything about it? They think anybody in prison is a bad guy or a bad woman. Little do they know. Little do they know.
Yeah.
It's exactly the opposite. It's horrible.
They're almost all poor.
Poor blacks, Latinos, two-thirds of them nonviolent.
And Indians,
And you're right.
70% of the people in prison in Saskatchewan, what appears to be non-U.S., but in these ways is very much 70% of the people are Indians. They're 5% of the population. Yeah.
Terrible.
The very racist institution.
Oh, just outrageous, John. We're almost out of time. Just a final thought by you before we end the program.
A thought from me?
Yeah.
Well,
we got about a minute.
Well, I'm thinking of this Occupy Wall Street as, you know, as you do, and as I think most people, as a kind of a turning point, and because they behaved like the U.S. police state at the beginning, and it went on for 3 weeks. These people were under basically long swinging truncheons and batteries, and basically the police. The protective force of the police were used solely to protect the Wall Street people. In fact, they were ferrying them back and forth continuously in cars. And so you see, really, here is the divide of whether the rule of law, whether the rule of armed force and so forth, is it for anything else but the cancer money sequences. And we have people standing up, if you want the model, at the cellular life community. This is what happens in cancer. You know that model, as soon as I saw the model, we are the 99%, I thought to myself, this is exactly the way it is at cancer at an earlier stage. The tiny, you know, little tiny development starts, that, like my brother who died of lung cancer a while ago, he's never a smoker, it started off as less than an inch in his lung, and he was dead within a year of a horrible death. And, of course, all those 70% of those cancer deaths come from smoke, toxic smoke, and from junk food. 70% of all cancers. But now 99% of the cell community of the United States, represented by the people in the Occupy Wall Street and occupying other places, are standing up saying something's dreadfully wrong. We have got to change. This is a life and death issue. And indeed it is. And my greatest hope, as I guess many others, is that this occupation spreads the way it has spread and doesn't let up. But one worries that the lack of policy understanding, just as when we talked about Egypt, the lack of policy understanding and direction, which itself people are afraid to bring out, is going to be a problem, so that we really just have what they'll eventually attack by armed force, and have the public rooting for it like they rooted for bombing Iraq. That's my worry.
Oh, and I hope, I don't know, but I certainly hope that the Occupy movement has legs. There are certainly a lot of committed people out there, John. I don't think they know the half of what they're up against. And if they go after the corporate interests, especially the moneyed interests, the money, power, and private hands that you and I think about all the time, if they go after that, they simply don't understand that they really are in the mother of all struggles. To wrest that power away from the people who have it, they will send out the Marines against you, and they will go.
Unless people wake up.
Oh, unless people wake up, and they're going to have to sustain this for the long run and literally put their bodies on the line and so on and so forth. John, we'll continue this when we get you back next month. I'll shoot you an email, send you one of the Berggren articles I wrote.
I sent you
my latest, and I look forward to doing this again, John.
Me too, Steve.
Thank you, John. And join us again each week, Thursdays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Make it a regular habit.